dad has a boat. He's like, well, you know, I just didn't think about it. So I really don't want to incriminate myself here. There's a statute of limitations, I think. So we're past that. But we go down to the Quakertown Marina here, and we go to the little, you know, ferry boat, and they say, hey, where are you going? He says, N10. So we jump in the boat. They take us out there. And if any of you have ever had a boat docked at N10, I promise we just sat on the boat. But we were sitting there fishing, and, you know, some things came up, and we were like, hey, you know, anything water, got any water in the boat? Well, I don't know. I was like, well, unlock the door. Let's go in and see if there's bottled water. I don't have the keys. I said, well, why would we come to the boat and you don't have the keys? So finally, I kept pushing, and he looked at me and said, hey, Tipton, this is not my dad's boat. My dad does not have a boat. I said, whose boat are we fishing on? He said, I have no idea. I said, well, then how did you know to tell him to go to N10? And he said, because I intend to have fun. So that was when I was in high school. That was plenty of years ago. I'm past, I can't get in trouble for that. We did not do anything wrong other than sit on somebody's boat that wasn't ours. Another instance, we were fishing. We had fished almost all night, and I was, you know, we were driving home, kind of took the back roads and just joyriding. I was driving down the road, and I was like, am I that tired, or am I really seeing what I think I'm seeing? I started to hit the brakes, and we had been in a part of Fayette County where a guy used to raise buffalo, and his buffalo were out crossing the road, and I was kind of doing the double take. But you know, when you fish all night, you're exhausted the next morning, but it's all worth it. It's enjoyable. You know, one third of the disciples, or the apostles, were fishermen. That's a pretty significant portion of the group. So four of the 12 are fishermen. Now, I'm not a professional fisherman. I don't do it for a living. These guys did. This is what they did. This was their livelihood. They fished. And so they were fishing before Jesus called them to follow him. And today we're going to see that the return to fishing after his crucifixion and resurrection. So we're going to conclude this series today, Resurrection Reactions, and we're going to take a look at the last chapter of John. So if you've been following along, we have been in John chapter 20 all the way through, and today we're in 21. And the disciples at this point have returned to Galilee, and where we pick up in kind of the storyline, they have spent all night fishing, and they didn't catch a single fish. And the next morning, as they're returning, before they return to shore, Jesus shows up. And like we've seen this in this whole series, when Jesus shows up, everything changes. So you can flip over to John chapter 21. As you do that, I'm going to give you a little context to what's going on here. You know, if you were following along and you read John chapter 20, you got to the end of chapter 20, and it felt like, wow, this is a really good way to end. It's a good spot. So this is the way John ends chapter 20, and it could be the ending of the book. He says, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Now, that seems to me like, boom, final, we're good to go. But then you get to 21. And it's like 21 is like a postscript to the letter. Now, there's been some debates. Was this added later in time? But a lot of commentators have come to kind of agreement. Like, it doesn't seem to be added later because a lot of the original manuscripts have 21 included. But what we get here is like kind of a tack on to the end of this gospel. And what it signifies for me is like that time period between the resurrection and before you get to Acts, where you have the birth of the church noted. And so there's that time period there, and John gives us a snapshot of kind of what was going on in these men and women's lives. So if you have your Bible, turn to 21. If you have your phone, pull out your YouVersion Bible app. I put that out on Facebook yesterday. There's an event. You can follow along that way. I'm going to kind of read this in stages and stop and just kind of give you some insight. So the first three verses of chapter 21, this is what John wrote. Afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. I'm going out to fish, Simon Peter told them, and they said, we'll go with you. So they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. You know, when I read this week, it's reminded my friend, hey, let's go fishing. I'm in. This is what Peter does. He said, hey, I'm going to go out and go fishing. And they're like, all right, sounds like a good plan. This is the third time Jesus appears to his disciples after the crucifixion. So think about, if you've been a part of this series with us, think back. The first time, the disciples were all locked in a room, but Thomas wasn't with them. The second time was a week later. All of the disciples are together again, and Thomas is there this time. And now this account, some of the disciples have left Jerusalem. They've gone back to Galilee. And I think the rest that aren't mentioned have probably gone back to what was once familiar as well. So these guys go to familiar territory. They go home. That's where they go. Most of them are from Galilee. They go home. They return to a familiar way of life. They return to what they were doing prior to Jesus' invitation to follow him. Now think about this. They had bills to pay. They had families that needed to be provided for. They needed to find something to do with their lives now that Jesus was gone. They had spent 3 years of their life tied to him. Everything about their life for that 3 years revolved around Jesus, revolved around his mission. And now, in their minds, it seems like maybe that is not a possibility. Even though they've seen him risen, they're kind of still in limbo. Like, what are we supposed to do? What's going on? And it's no surprise to me that it's Peter, who's been the ringleader of this group the whole time, is the one that says, hey, I know what we do. Let's go fishing. Now, listen, Peter did not go fishing to clear his mind. That's why I go fishing. You know, yesterday I took the older two kids. We went down the road to a pond, and we fished for about an hour and a half, and I did it to clear my mind. Peter did it to make a living. Big difference. He's not, this isn't Peter's attempt to say, hey, I just need to go get in the water. I need to get things out of my mind, off my chest. It's not that way. Peter's like, I'm going to go to work. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back to doing what I was doing before Jesus showed up. He knew fishing. His family knew fishing. It was the family business. And the others, they join in. They fish all night long. And I think this is what is miraculous to me. The miracle is not the fact that we're going to read later, Jesus provides a catch of 153 fish. The miracle for me is they fish all night long and don't catch anything. These guys are professional fishermen. Now, maybe they're a little rusty because they haven't done it for 3 years, but they fish all night. They don't catch a single thing. Now, if you know the New Testament, hopefully you're like, hey, this story sounds familiar. I was back in my room last night going over these notes. Grace comes in. She's like, hey, Dad, you working on your sermon? I said, well, I'm just refreshing my memory, you know, just touching some things up. She said, what are you talking about tomorrow? I said, well, I'm talking about Jesus when he goes to the disciples and they're fishing and they don't catch anything. She says, oh, I know that story. So he says, hey, let me borrow your boat and I want to go out there and teach. And after he teaches, he lets the disciples put their nets down and they catch a bunch of fish. I said, well, that's actually not the story that I'm preaching about tomorrow, but that's the parallel story. And so if you know the New Testament, you get to this point and you're like, wait a minute. Haven't we heard this miracle of catching fish before they fished all night? And this is what John is doing. So go to verse 4. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. He called out to them, friends, haven't you any fish? No, they answered. He said, throw your net on the right side of the boat and you will find some. When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it's the Lord. As soon as Simon Peter heard him say it is the Lord, he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off and jumped into the water. So, this situation is remarkably close to the very first time Jesus calls those first disciples. Luke chapter 5, Jesus is standing there by the Sea of Galilee. He gets in a boat, he teaches. After he says, hey, let your nets down. They said, but we've fished all night long. We haven't caught anything. And so kind of Peter, he's like, but because you say to let the nets down, we'll do it. And they do it. They catch a miraculous catch of fish. This catch is so big, Luke tells us that the nets are breaking. And so when we get to this point in the story, this third time Jesus appears to his disciples, it's kind of familiar from two different perspectives, two different angles. The disciples go back to what's familiar in life, and Jesus uses a familiar miracle to get their attention. The first time Jesus performed this miracle, Peter's response was, get away from me. I'm a sinful man. But notice what he does this time. Just read it in verse 7. Peter hears John say, oh, it's the Lord. And he's standing there in his loincloth. He grabs his clothes, wraps it around him. He dives into the water and swims to the shore. It's a completely different reaction this time. The first time he's like, hey, I don't even want to have anything to do with you. I'm sinful. Peter gets to the point this time where he's like, hey, it's the Lord. I don't care. I'm jumping. I'm swimming to him. I'm getting as fast as I can. Now, the reality is Peter still knew he was a sinful man. Peter was still dealing with his own denial of Jesus. Just prior to the crucifixion, he had denied Jesus three times, but that didn't matter. Because Peter knew who Jesus was, this time the reaction is, he's here, I need to get close to him. Now, here's I think, the big point we learned from this whole interaction that Jesus has this third time with his disciples. And I think this is huge for us to understand. As we seek Jesus or as we ask questions about God, I would encourage you to write this down. An encounter with Jesus changes us, not the world around us. An encounter with Jesus changes us, not the world around us. These men and women that encounter Jesus here at the end of this gospel, they were not removed from the difficulty of life. The threat from the Jewish people, because of their affiliation with Jesus, was still there. It might have diminished to some degree, but they were still kind of threatened just for being associated with Jesus. These people still had needs. They had everyday life needs. They had issues to attend to. Life did not stop, and the demands that life bring didn't stop either, just because they knew who Jesus was. And the same is true for us. Everyday life situations and circumstances do not change when we choose to have an encounter with Jesus. Jesus changes us in the midst of those things. You know, I think one of the things that happens in the church world is that we see this invitation to follow Jesus, and somehow, some way, we muddy the waters enough to try to get people to understand that, hey, if you follow Jesus, everything's going to be okay. If you follow Jesus, life's going to be great. That's not what we see in the Gospels. The invitation to follow Jesus does not mean that evil, suffering, pain, and the demands of this current life automatically disappear. Accepting an invitation to follow Jesus does not mean that we become exempt from suffering. It doesn't mean that we become exempt from the experience of evil in this world. What it means is he's present with us in those times. And I think in this text, what we see when we understand Jesus, an encounter with Jesus changes us. It doesn't change the world around us. I think we see three ways. When we ask that question, how does Jesus really change us? I think in this text, we see three ways that Jesus changes us. The first thing we see is his reassuring presence. Throughout this series, this is one of the things that we have explored from beginning to end. Every interaction that Jesus has with people after the resurrection, it's a reassuring thing. Think about the reaction that Mary has. So the very first week we talked about Mary. Week number one, he turns Mary's grief to joy. He could have criticized her. He's like, why? He could have said, why are you so sad? You knew I was going to raise from the dead. He didn't do that. He reassures her. He changes her grief to joy. Week two, he shows up. The disciples are locked in a room. They're terrified. They're afraid for their lives. And just his presence and his greeting, he says, peace be with you. He changes their fear to rejoicing. Last week, we looked at Thomas. Thomas was one of those guys that had questions. He needed answers to the questions. He had doubts. And Jesus takes those doubts. He doesn't criticize him for the doubt. He doesn't call him out for having questions. He takes the doubt and uses the doubt to lead Thomas to an undeniable faith. Now, this week, we don't see these guys questioning. We don't see these women questioning in this situation. But what we do find them doing is returning to an old pattern of life. They're not doing what he commissioned them to do. He had already told them, hey, I'm sending you out, just like God sent me out. I'm sending you out into the world. But for whatever reason, between that encounter and between the infilling of the Holy Spirit in Acts chapter 2, these guys, they go back to their old way of life. And here we have Jesus again standing on the shore. And his presence enough alone, it's enough to reinvigorate them. You know, Peter just hears, hey, it's Jesus. Dives in, and he goes there. Jesus' presence is as real today for us as it was for them on that lakeshore. It is just as real today. And I think this is one of the greatest blessings of the Christian faith. It's the presence of Jesus in the midst of whatever life brings. You know, one of the objections that I hear to the Christian faith often from people that are questioning or people that are skeptical is like, you Christians are so good at giving God credit when everything goes good, but you don't have much to say when things go bad. You know, the first time I heard that, like, I kind of let it soak in and I thought about it. I thought about my own experience in the church. And I think there's some truth to that. I think that a lot of times in life, when things are going great, we're so fast to give God credit. But when things are going bad, you know, we don't talk about God as much. And one of those questions that gets asked is like, in the midst of suffering and pain in life, in the midst of sickness, in the midst of disease, in the midst of turmoil, where is God? And the reality is, what we see in Scripture, he's present. He's there. Jesus shows up in some of the most difficult times in these people's lives. And the story of Jesus alone is the story of God inserting himself into the pain and suffering of the world to initiate his ultimate purpose of restoration. So this encounter is the reassurance that Jesus is present. And one of the privileges of believing that Jesus really is who he says he is that he's there even in the familiarity of life. Now, I want to point out something I found very interesting in this text. If you skip down to verse 12, you'll find this. Jesus said to them, come and have some breakfast. And this is what I paid particular attention to. None of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. And I read that and I'm like, okay, but did they know or not? Because there's kind of like this, is it really him? Because they want to ask, but they didn't dare ask. And John says, they knew it was the Lord. You know, in this series, we looked at this word saw when John said, they saw Jesus, or we have seen the Lord. It's a word that has two meanings. And when we see that word in Greek, saw, it's like we physically saw Jesus with our eyes, but it was also, wait, we perceived him with our minds. We understood for the first time who he was. And this word knew, it's kind of the same. It's a Greek word that's interpreted two different ways. It's like you see it or you actually just know it. And so for me, when I look at this, it doesn't really appear that they recognize Jesus physically. And this isn't uncommon. If you read the encounter of the two men on the road to Emmaus, you know, Jesus shows up and he's talking with them along the way, and they don't know who it is. Matter of fact, they said, "Don't you are you the only person that doesn't know what's been going on?" And they explain everything that happened to Jesus, yet he's standing right there. And here we see kind of the same situation where these guys who spent 3 years, do they recognize him or not? In their hearts, they knew it was him, but their eyes didn't perceive him. So what is it? Here's what one commentator wrote, and I think it sums it up perfectly. In spite of an apparent change in his outward appearance, the disciples' spiritual instinct confirmed his identity. Now, what does that mean? It means that his presence, regardless of his outward physical appearance, his presence in that situation was reassuring. His presence in our life is reassuring. But here's the catch. It requires discernment to see him. The two on the way to Emmaus were told that the Lord opened their eyes. And so we ask that question, like, how do we know? How can we become aware of God's presence in our life? I think the easiest step to get to that point is to ask God to give us eyes to see him. It's to say, help me see you. That's a prayer that I pray regularly here at Hannah's Creek, is God, help me see where you're at. Help me see where you're moving. And I think when we ask, our eyes are open to see his presence in everyday life. It's the first thing. The second thing that I think he changes in us as we encounter him is we get to experience his remarkable provision. So they fished all night. They didn't catch a single fish. Jesus shows up. He says, "Cast your nets on the other side of the boat." And John tells us exactly how many fish they catch, 153. Now, I know there's some people out there in this group that they see these numbers and they like to like, okay, what's that number mean? Every number's symbolic, right? Don't get caught up in this number. I don't think this is symbolic at all. You can read some commentators and they'll tell you, hey, you 5 + 3 + 1, and you get all this symbolism. I don't think it's symbolism. I think it's, you know, it's 153. It's the number that a person that was there that experienced it would remember. You know, I tell you how many fish I caught yesterday. I caught 6 fish yesterday. Okay. These guys, John's like, hey, we caught 153 fish. We counted them. Why did they count them? Because we divvied them out. Like, we split them up evenly. What do we got to see in this? Listen, don't get caught up in the number. Get caught up in the fact that the efforts of these men fell short. They go out all night. They fish. They don't catch anything. It is not until Jesus shows up that he provides all that they need and more. That's the point. Now notice, Jesus says, hey, you got any fish? I mean, no, we don't have any fish. And so when they get ashore, he's like, well, bring a few fish here. But when they show up around the fire, guess what's already there cooking? Fish. He did not need their fish. They actually didn't need the 153 fish. They wanted to eat. Jesus had the fish ready. He said, hey, I'm going to go over and above. I'm going to give you more than you need. This account helps us understand that Jesus' presence in our lives brings us to a place of remarkable provision. Now listen, I've experienced this in my life. I'm going to tell you a couple stories. And I used to hear these stories when I was younger. I'd hear these preachers say, you know, I had one preacher that I loved dearly, and he was kind of like a mentor to me, and he would always tell the same story, like, I went to a church to preach, and I didn't have any money, and I preached. I didn't even have money to go to McDonald's and buy a cheeseburger, you know, and lo and behold, at the end of the service, they give him enough money, he can go to McDonald's and eat. So I was like, man, that sounds fishy to me. But when you experience it, it doesn't seem so fishy. So here's a couple experiences that I've had. Early in my ministry, when I was in seminary, trying to run a business, go to seminary, have a family, there were times, and Barbara can attest to this, there were times when it felt like, it seemed like, if we continued to pursue God's desire for our life, we would go broke, literally. I can't tell you how many times in that process, I would go to the mailbox and there would be a check that we did not expect to get. I promise. I can't tell you how many funerals I did during that period of time. It seemed like I was the only guy in Connersville doing funerals. And the reason was because every time a funeral popped up, we needed a little extra money. Just so happened somebody would die. They didn't have a minister. The family wants them to have a proper funeral. Funeral home would call. Hey, could you do this funeral? Yeah, you better believe it. This is what I don't want you to hear. This is not what I'm trying to say here. Coming to Christ does not promise an abundance of wealth. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that when we have faith in Jesus, we are not exempt from poverty. We're not exempt from financial hardship. But what I see John communicating is that when we come to Jesus, he will provide us with exactly what we need to continue to seek him. That's the key. I can't tell you how many times, it's not just financial, but I can't tell you how many times on a Saturday I've cried out to God, God, I do not know what I'm supposed to say tomorrow. I've studied all week and I have nothing. And he gives me just what I need before Sunday. So that's the second thing, his remarkable provision. And the third thing I think is the most powerful. It's his restored purpose. When you get to verses 15 through 17, this is what you find. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, he said, you know that I love you. That's one time, so keep track of that. Yes, Lord, he said, you know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my lambs. Again, Jesus said, number two, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said, take care of my sheep. And then the third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. You know, just like this account of the fishing parallels Luke, the first time that Jesus calls his disciples, this account where he takes Peter and he asks him three times parallels Peter's three denials that happened just prior to his crucifixion. Three times Peter said, I don't know him. I don't know him. I don't know him. And Jesus asked him three times, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? And the parallels are deeper than that, because when Peter denies him, he's standing around a fire warming himself. Now Jesus has him on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, and they're around a fire, and Jesus says, hey, Peter, do you love me? You know I love you. Hey, Peter, do you love me? Yeah, you know I love you. Peter, do you really love me? Jesus, you know all things. You know that I love you. And what is Jesus doing? He is restoring Peter. He goes on to say, hey, feed my lambs, take care of my sheep, feed my sheep. It's a restoration. Jesus is reassuring Peter, hey, I know you denied me, but that doesn't change the fact that I've given you a purpose. That purpose is to lead and to feed his sheep. Encountering Jesus in our lives restores our purpose in life. Some of us, like Peter, may be called to lead and feed the sheep. But I want you to understand that Jesus does not call everybody to the same kind of life. He doesn't call everybody to lead and feed. Jesus calls people to different kinds of careers, different places in life. And the truth is, God can redeem and restore whatever field you find yourself in. Wherever he has placed you in this moment, God can restore his good purpose in that for the good of all around.